My name's Dr. Menago by Mike. My dad was Greek, but legally it's Menakalphus. We're going to talk about the disease of chemical addiction today. My background is that I graduated UK Medical School, went to Cincinnati for my family practice training, and then ended up from Cincinnati going to a little town called Falmouth, Kentucky. If you know where Falmouth is. Well, the place that I was hired by a group to start a new office, and the building that office was in was an old county hospital. And it was that now, at that point, for 15 or 20 years, had housed a 28-bed addiction unit. That's what they used it for. So during my time in medical school and residency and wandering through the secular world, my faith got increasingly diminished. I became increasingly agnostic. I could play the church game pretty well. I could even, with my kids, I wanted them to grow up with it, but I had trouble believing. Do I really believe this stuff? And I was in a really bad spiritual spot around 97 to 2001. 97 is when I started treating people with addiction. The town Falmouth flooded, almost destroyed it, and I was forced, pretty much against my will, into being the drug and alcohol doc. Offered a little bit of money, but not given choice to say no. I did it begrudgingly, and like Jonah, I found out when you try to avoid God's plan for your life, he hits you over the head pretty hard. What's interesting is a lot of people with addictions will say they got saved through their addiction. I feel like I kind of got saved through other people's addiction, because it was the realization of that. I have to do everything backwards. My wife will agree to that, but I'm the guy that I had to recognize the spiritual warfare aspect of it, and I had to realize that I was battling something, and I realized that was Satan. And realizing that spiritual warfare, that made that God has to be real. It's like, you know, when you know there's a devil, you hope God's real, right? When you recognize the devil in there. Because too often in our lives, we don't even recognize the devil. The devil doesn't have to convince you to follow him, right? He just has to convince you God's not real. But when you start to realize he's real, there's got to be a God there. And, you know, one of the first things that I learned is science and God don't need to be in opposition. You know, we always think that you've got to be either, you know, if your faith is strong enough, it'll just, you don't need the science, you don't need the others, you don't need to know what the secular world thinks. You've got God in your pocket. Well, God doesn't call you to have your head in the sand. You know, there's the parable in the Synoptic Gospels of the, you know, the master leaving talents with somebody. And he comes back, and the one that just buried him in the sand and waited is scolded. If you're given talents, you use them. That means secular knowledge is part of you. You use it. It's not going to contradict God. If it seemingly contradicts, you just need to look until you understand it. But God's not going to contradict science, and science isn't going to contradict God. Your understanding and your opinion of it may, of what it means. But if that makes any sense. We're going to talk about brain chemistry for a minute. That's really what, you didn't come to hear me preach. That's not my forte. That wasn't the talent the master left me with. But are all addictions equal? You know, we're told they are, right? I mean, you go to an AA meeting and alcohol and coke, it's all just an addiction. You beat them the same way. Well, it's true. Those 12 steps are a good roadmap that work to help rebuild a life. But ignoring the fact that there are differences physically from one addiction to another is very dangerous. So they are the same to a point, but there are differences. And when we talk about opiate addiction, one thing about opiate addiction, I'm going to give you a little, no talk on neurobiology would be appropriate without a brain picture, right? So here's the brain picture. The limbic system is this part of your brain, basically, that if you took a fish's brain out, it would have the same part. What God gave us, he didn't give a fish, is this big, thick cortex. That's where we think and our complex neurological things are carried out. And in that limbic system, you got to realize the limbic system is involuntary. So instincts, patterns of behavior, things like that that happen below conscious thought occur in that limbic system. The cortex is thinking and learning, and the cortex does have a control over the limbic system, but it's slow and requires training. It's not instantaneous, right? So keep in mind that the limbic system is not under conscious control, not under voluntary control. Now, one difference between alcohol and opiates or cocaine and opiates, for example, in your brain, your brain's this incredible biochemical computer. Chemicals bind to receptors to cause things to happen, right? And the way I would say that is a receptor in your brain is like a lock on a door. And the chemical that binds to it is a key. And keys can be agonists that stimulate, they bind that key, turn the lock, something happens. Or they can be an antagonist that blocks the lock, right? You have something called mu opioid. You have like four or five types of opiate receptors. An opiate is a drug that does something like morphine does. Morphine or heroin or oxycodone or Vicodin. Those are all opiate drugs. They bind to these certain types of receptors called opioid receptors. In that subtype, there's a mu receptor, mu, the Greek letter mu. And the mu receptor is important because it is what allows you, when you stimulate a mu receptor, you feel calm, at peace with the universe. All's good. You know, the runner's high is in endorphins and enkephalins being stimulated. You actually get that up through exercise. It's a normal thing in your body that stimulates a mu receptor that makes you feel normal and happy and content. What happens is when a mu receptor gets stimulated, dopamine surges in that limbic system, in the brain part we were talking about. But that surge is involuntary. I just said you need that to feel good. Other things, dopamine is the final common pathway of all addictions, right? For the most part. The endorphins are unique to opioids, with the exception that alcohol may weakly stimulate an opioid receptor, 30% or so, 40%. One thing we notice in the biology of this is that people that are, if you look at, there's usually family histories in a lot of opioid addicted individuals, right? Where if you look at their family history, there's alcoholic, 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 alcoholic. Now all the cousins are addicted to heroin or whatever. We know that 20% of the population has a hyperstimulatable mu receptor that's very sensitive. And the minute that it gets stimulated, even the first time, this explains why a lot of people are trapped the first time they use it, is they're trapped and it's like, whoa! Yes, and they're obsessed. It's like they have to keep trying to hit that pleasure button, because when heroin hits that receptor that hard, or another opiate hits that receptor that hard, it's like, what have you been waiting for all my life? One question I'll ask young people, I know they say they have knee surgery. I'll stop and ask them, by the way, that Percocet they gave you, how did it make you feel? Because I don't know about you guys, but I say 4 out of 5 people in this room, if I gave you a big Percocet, you'd go to sleep within an hour, sleep it off, feel kind of groggy. You ever see somebody that has that neurobiological potential to be addicted, give them a Percocet. Man, this is great. I'm going to clean my house. I'm going to do... Bingo. I take that kid. I said, I warn you, do not take anything that you don't absolutely have to take, because you're going to have trouble with it. You know, that's one way of telling whether this person might have a potential problem. So the mu receptor gets stimulated, and eventually you stop making endorphin. Why make it if you're going to give me, your brain says, if you're going to give me something that makes, that does 10 times what I normally make, why would I go through the trouble making this? Which is great as long as you're taking it, but try stopping it. You know, anybody that's been depressed or had suicidal thoughts or whatever, and they've been sober for a year, bingo, the endorphins didn't kick back in. You don't have that problem with cocaine. You know, after a year, the brain chemistry is normalized. You don't have the brain refusing to make something that it needed to be healthy. You know, so there is a difference in some of these. You know, we want to say it's their fault. They did this themselves. They made it. Sure. You know what? Just like a lot of us older folks, when we were kids, we'd sneak into daddy's liquor cabinet, take a swig of his whiskey. You know, I want to admit if you did that. They do that with our Vicodin bottles. That's why these take back prescription programs are so big. Now, granted, they did that, they started doing it, and it was a bad habit, they screwed up, I'll give it to them. How many of us did something stupid when we were a kid? I mean, you don't have to put your hand up, but if you don't put your hand up, you're lying. What if you're trapped in it? What if you're trapped in it? That's the point. You know, I hate hearing these, well, they did this to themselves. Why? Yeah, sure, okay, they walked into a trap. That doesn't mean we don't get them out of it. This is just what is about endorphins, what they do. The effects of opiates on the brain in general. Opiate drugs hit the limbic system and feel feelings of pleasure. They also hit the brainstem, that lower part of the limbic system that controls autonomic body functions, bowel movements, breathing, things like that. What we use them for is this one. They block messages transmitted to by the spinal cord. You know, you cut your arm off, you cut your arm off, you're going to find out pretty good because that message travels up. Well, opioids, to some extent, will block that being transmitted. That's what it does. That's why we use them. So when you bind to endorphin receptors in the pain pathway of the thalamus, brainstem, spinal cord, you get analgesia. You do it in the reward pathway, dopamine's released, the person feels good. What I mean by that is, when you, like I said, that mu receptor being stimulated raises dopamine levels and sets up a feel-good pattern in that subconscious part of your brain. Remember, it's subconscious, all right? Good, Lori. So what happens when you stop, when you're taking an opioid regularly, whether you're using it as prescribed, you might be taking the 4 Percocet a day the doctor prescribed you, or you're using heroin or something illegally. If it's a short-acting drug like heroin or Percocet or Vicodin, 6 to 12 hours you're going to start with these withdrawal symptoms, and it's going to peak about 72 hours. If you use a longer-acting opioid like OxyContin or methadone or whatever, it might be longer. Maybe it's 30 hours before you start feeling sick. And the symptoms of withdrawal are nausea, vomiting, stomach cramps, diarrhea, goosebumps, depression, cravings. Like the worst case of the flu you've ever had times 10 is what a patient told me once. Opioid withdrawal won't kill you, but there's a day or two where you wish you were dead. You feel horrible, but now it might be life-threatening if you have enough diarrhea and enough vomiting that you get. I really should have made handouts, shouldn't I? I didn't think they'd be that important. I'm sorry. But if you get like electrolyte abnormalities where your potassium is dropping because of diarrhea, that kind of thing, it's going to cause a problem. But usually it's not life-threatening. Alcohol withdrawal can kill you. You go into delirium tremens or DTs with alcohol, 15% of those people die. They can quit breathing, they can have seizures, all kinds of things. So alcohol withdrawing is actually more lethal than opioid withdrawal. It's just we don't see that severe of an alcohol withdrawal that often anymore, thank God. So on a cycle, that's kind of the physical. That's what's going on, the physical part of your brain when you're doing this. Let's talk for a second about psychological. Anybody here know who Ivan Pavlov was? Pavlov was 1880s maybe, something like that. He was a Russian, one of the pioneers in psychology. And he developed this concept called operant conditioning. And a very simple experiment, we use it all the time. He said, he rang a bell and fed a dog. What did the dog do for when you rang the bell after a while? Got salivated, got ready to eat. His eating behaviors were triggered just by ringing the bell. That's how we train animals, right? It's called reinforcement. We reinforce it, we do it. Well, we do that too. That's what triggers are to an addicted person. The things that trigger them to have a craving to salivate for their drug are the things that they associated with their using, right? So that lies within the dopamine of the limbic system. So you've set up a system that now has to be fed. And if it's not fed, dopamine falls and there's discomfort. Now with that dog, if you ring the bell and feed him, everything goes great. What happens when you stop feeding him? He'll keep doing it for a little bit, but then you go into extinction. The behavior quits, right? What happens when now 6 months after he's extinguished the behavior, you start doing it again? You take him and a dog that's never been trained, and you do the experiment again. Which one do you think is going to train faster? The dog that was trained before, right? Because he's got memory in that limbic system of what happened before. And when the trigger starts getting reinforced, all of a sudden it comes back really quick. That's exactly what happens to our addicted friends, right? The trigger, they don't use, so the triggers start to subside. But the minute they give into it, it's boom, they've opened up. So from a physical and a psychological standpoint, they fall back into the hole again. Make sense? Now, in treatment, psychologists or counselors will often use, I like this model because I think it explains a lot about how to treat people. It's called the stages of change or the circle of change, cycle of change, whatever you want. It's not just with addiction. It's with any change we need to make. It could be with a gambling addiction. It could be I want to get my weight under control. It could be any positive change you need to make, this applies to. You go through stages. The first is pre-contemplation. A pre-contemplative is someone's, I don't have a problem. Hey, I'm fat and happy. There's a problem. I'm the healthiest fat guy I know. I might be fat, but by golly, I'm in good shape for me, you know. To the alcoholic, you know, I had one too many beers with my friends, but that cop was just harassing me. I blew a .0. There's no way I blew a .08. It's somebody else's fault, right? They deny the fault. In contemplation, the next step. Okay, maybe there's a problem, but you know what? You're overplaying it. It's not as bad as you say it is. Just leave me alone. I'll fix it. I can do this. I can handle this. That's a contemplative, right? You see how this cycle goes along. Preparation and action, I usually combine into one. That's the point where, like in AA, they say, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired, right? Whatever it takes. Yeah, I need out of this. I need help. I'll do whatever you tell me, Doc. What do I need to do? All right, they're coming to you. They're broken. Psychologists often tell you can't really help anybody until they get into here. But, and you know what? In our abstinence-based treatment models for alcoholism, I think I skipped over this last hour, but our abstinence-based treatment models pretty much are bent on that treatment approach, right? They'll come in here. You know, guy gets a DUI. If he's here, we put him in rehab. He leaves. We know he's coming back. He's not going to take. You know, he's pre-contemplative. Counselor writes a note. Still pre-contemplative. We'll expect him to return. Not likely to benefit from treatment. And with an alcoholic, we can usually wait that out, right? Because they'll come back. Maybe the second or third time they'll finally be here. These heroin kids die up here. That's another difference between alcohol and heroin, or cocaine or meth and heroin, is they don't make it out of here because the lethality of what they're doing, the overdose potential. So now we've thrown, and I was saying that before fentanyl hit the market. My goodness, fentanyl's just taking that through the roof. Once you've gone through that phase and you successfully do what you need to do, you move into maintenance. That's chronic, stable, sober recovery. You stay in maintenance, hopefully forever. Unfortunately, relapse occurs. And when you relapse, the whole process has to start over again. You know, I was just telling this to a guy yesterday at my office. He's here, 15 years sober off heroin. He relapsed on cocaine. And he's thinking he's going right back to here. Doesn't work that way. You got to go through the whole thing again. You know, we have this conundrum in our treatment. There's the total abstinence folks and the brain disease folks. And we see them as dichotomous opinions that don't connect. You know, the abstinence-only folks are saying that, you know, they have to be sick enough to want this. And I'm not knocking them, actually. I appreciate what they do. But their opinion is when they're sick enough, they'll come to. You know, they'll come to their knees and they'll come to their senses kind of thing. And the brain disease folks want to excuse all their behavior, saying, well, they can't help it. Their brain's dead. You know, don't. The reality is they're both right. Okay? What moves you through this process are the external forces that your life puts in your path. You know? You don't do anything without a fear of going to jail or promise of a reward. Or we don't do anything in our life. You know? That's just part of our human nature. And jail's not treatment. But some people do need to go to jail. Now, when they get to jail, I don't agree with the way we do jail once they get there. Yeah, let me say that. So going to jail sometimes, if we had, you know, proper medical and detox services and treatment that started in jail that carried over when they were released, cool. You know, I said this earlier, you know, I see patients all the time that have, they're in drug court and they've got a felony charge and their only felony was possession. Now, one guy had a master's in business degree and he's dead. He overdosed 2 weeks ago. You get a felony, the job you can get is $10, $12 an hour with no flexibility in the schedule. You miss a day, you're fired. But you've got a judge that's telling you you've got to go to IOP 4 hours, 3 times a week. Got to meet a case manager. If you're in a Suboxone program, maybe you've got to meet their peer group therapy. You know, you've got all these requirements on top of a $10 an hour job that'll hire a felon. It's not particularly flexible. And you don't have a driver's license. And we wonder why they relapse. The minute they miss one of those things, we throw them back in jail. And after a while, they just get frustrated. They just quit trying, and they overdose and die. That's becoming the normal pattern for this, and it needs to stop. I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, they drive high. Society needs protected from you. And you're driving high, you get arrested, you're released, and you start driving it anyway without a license. Okay, maybe you need to serve a little time because you're going to kill somebody. That's, you know, your right to be treated doesn't supersede other people's rights to be able to travel the highway safe. However, we make a felony and ruin their life out of possessing the thing that they need to feel normal. And we don't give them a way out. Which, if that's the choice we make as a society, we want to be harsh. That's fine. We'll face God's wrath for that decision. You know, none of us are to be, with my last quote, you'll see my true feelings on that when I get to the end here. But the consequences are important. And in reality, both of those camps are right. We just have to give them the right door, and we got to rethink how we do this. So we've talked about a physical connection and a psychological issue, a psychological connection. And really, it's a three-tiered approach. You got to have the spiritual connection as well. There's a type of counseling, and a lot of people have different issues with this, but it has some great points. It's called sozo counseling. And in that counseling construct, they say that spiritual warfare attacks you through one of four doors. There's four vulnerabilities, if you will. In other words, when Satan decides to attack you, he's going to watch your behavior and figure out which one of these you're more susceptible to. And he's going to plow through it. Fear. How many times do we do things out of fear? Dr. Jeremiah has a great book out, What Are You Afraid Of? Talks all about that door of fear. David Jeremiah, if you haven't read that, it's a great book. Lust. Not just for sex, but just for any kind of pleasurable activity. Hedonism. Right? We want to feed our selfish, our id. You know, feed that selfish desire. Well, he gets us through that sometimes. That's temptation. Offense, which is my personal biggest door. You want to tick me off? Man, get me started. Get my pride feathers flared up. Some things will come out of my mouth that I won't admit I said later on. So my wife always laughs when I do that because she's like, yep. And then the last door is sorcery. And sorcery really I would define as any god that replaces God, any false god. Drugs are a false god, obviously, right? The word pharmakia, interestingly, pharmakia in Greek, the word we get pharmaceuticals from, translates as sorcery, interestingly. So the point is that adequate recovery is going to need body, mind, and spirit all. All these aspects are needed. I got to help you with the brain chemistry. The psychological aspects have to be taken care of. The spiritual aspects have to be taken care of. I tell people going to AA all the time, AA is great, I'm not knocking it, but it has been, in some cases, overtooled to not offend people. You know, the original idea of AA in the 30s focused on Christ. It was a God-centered approach. And, you know, Bill W. would not have argued that. They changed some of the words and they water them down a little bit because not everybody's ready, you know. Jesus recognized that, right? When he would approach people that were lame or healed or blind or whatever, you know, he didn't just walk right up and say, forget your blindness, follow me, right? No, he healed their blindness and then used the opportunity of the open mind to bring the gospel to them, tell them the gospel truth that they were missing. And it's the same way. It's like, you know, but AA will say, like, you know, God as I understand him, because they're trying not to offend people, you know, and I get that. But really, your higher power is God. I tell people, you know, the higher power is defined as anything that gets you through today. And in AA meetings, I've heard them say it could be that light switch, it could be that chair. Okay, if that gets you through today, kids are a higher power, right? That's something you get strength to stay sober from. That's not going to last forever. The only permanent, ultimate higher power is God. You want a 20-year coin, you got to get him. Missing any of these is going to result in failure and relapse eventually. Another thing I like to bring up is the brain's an organ, just like your heart or your liver. How many people would follow and respect a pastor that's told their heart failure patient, stop taking your Lasix and your Carvedilol. Let's just pray this through. You know, and well, sure, God works that way sometimes, but not usually. You know, God doesn't allow us to command the Holy Spirit to heal things and we're given the gift of healing and your medical problem just goes away. You know, there's the old you know, sermon story of the guy caught on a roof during a flood. And a boat comes up and the driver says, get in the boat. Now wait on God, he's going to save me. Later on, a helicopter comes by, drops a rope, climb up. Now God's going to save me. Guy drowns. He's standing in front of God. I thought you were going to save me. I had faith. So what do you mean? I sent a boat and a helicopter. You know, sometimes we question God on how he chooses to do it. But, you know, it's funny. With this organ, we expect people just to be able to will it and pray it into submission. But other organs, we don't do that with. And I don't, that's not necessarily the brain. You know, a stable brain that's not working well, that's an organ. We need to help that organ work properly. We got to feed that physical need so that the spiritual becomes possible. And sometimes that means stabilizing their brain. So I'm kind of bouncing back and forth here, the importance of the abstinence-based stuff, but sometimes the chemical stuff is important too. Just like the heart failure patient, the brain needs stabilized. Next. That's okay. So is addiction really a disease? Back in 2013, we had a group I work with in Northern Kentucky, we had a breakfast with some legislators from Northern Kentucky, like 33 of them, state senators and representatives. And I was given 15 minutes to basically do what I'm doing with you all in 40 to a bunch of members of the state legislature. So that was really terrifying. Thank you. So as I was preparing for that, I was terrified. And what I spent 2 weeks trying to prepare. I kept redoing it. I'm like, what am I going to say in 15 minutes is going to be relevant? God hits me with this epiphany as I'm literally pulling off the exit minutes before I walked in front of this room. And I walked in and I just said, I'm going to talk to y'all today about adult type 2 diabetes. And they're all looking around like, what? Okay, did he miss his medication this morning? And I said, you know, I'm an adult diabetic. I'm a type 2 diabetic. I have a genetic predisposition. I made some bad personal choices. And because of that, I have a disease that wants to kill me. Now, I went to my doctor. My doctor sent me to a counselor, a dietitian, who is trying to teach me to fix my bad behaviors. In the meantime, they put me on a medication. Now, my doctor looks at me, where I am in my disease and what I need, and decides whether it's insulin or this pill or that pill. But she and I decide what I need, and she helps me with it. A small percentage of people are maybe going to say, you know what, I'm going to take to heart what this dietitian said. I'm going to do it 100%. I'm going to lose 40 or 50 pounds, and I'm not going to take your medicine. I don't need it. And if that works, that's fine, but that's going to be like 5% or less. That's a small number. The rest are going to need something. Now, some of them are going to be on that for a while and say, you know what, I really want to get off this insulin. Let me start working. Let me fix myself. You know, let me follow the diet and exercise, and they'll get off the insulin. Some are going to be on the insulin for a long term, but they're going to stay perfectly stable, or they're going to switch to other medicines. Some people are still not going to do it in spite of all that and lose their feet, end up on dialysis, and they're going to die, right, even with the best medical care. Does any of this sound familiar? Okay. Is this a disease? Yeah. It is. And the way I transition that is, you know, fortunately for me, cheesecake isn't illegal. But that's, you know. And that's the best comparison I can. Sure, there's differences. I get it. It's not a perfect analogy, but no analogy is perfect. But the point is, it's a disease, and a doctor needs a treat. You know, I see one of the things that I'm an advocate for properly using, I use that word properly, in bold type and all caps and underline three times, properly using is Suboxone. People have their biases, and I understand that. But when we use Suboxone and we see somebody get better, you know, there's this camp that says you only use it for detox, or you got to get them off that stuff after a year. Why? Why? Do we tell the diabetic patient, you didn't lose 40 pounds in a year, I'm stopping your insulin? Man, you'd lose your medical license for that, and you should. But that's how we treat addicted people. I get it. When Suboxone, in one of the arguments, Suboxone came out, it was for detox. Yeah, but we didn't know we could make addicts live 20 years back then. You know? There's the other side of the coin is never stop it. That's a bit egregious, but one of the advocates of that is one of the greatest minds in addiction medicine, Dr. Adam Bezalga at Columbia. He's the head of their addiction program. He did some of the research on Suboxone. And he says, look, that you take it off, a high percentage relapse when you stop it. And if they're living normally and they're doing well, why are you stopping it? To fit some arbitrary, made-up dream of what normal is? So that they could meet your normal off of medicine? They're alive, they're functioning, they're doing well, they're not high, they're paying their bills, they're raising their kids. Why do you want to stop it? You know, he's got a point. So when patients come to me, I ask, when they say, I want to get off this, I'll ask them after a few months, I'll say, what do you think about getting off of this? Or they'll come to me and say, I want to get off of this. My first thought is, where are they in that circle? Okay? If they're in a good place in that circle, okay, let's very slowly go down. But I know that there's a certain percentage of them that aren't going to resume that endorphin function, right? Because taking that medicine, taking that opiate they were using, and then the Suboxone, the idea is the brain's supposed to start making endorphins again. Maybe it doesn't. And a fair percentage, it doesn't. I've got people that were on 16, 20 milligrams of Suboxone for years. I've got them down to 2 milligrams. I can't get them off the last two. I don't care. They come in, their urine test is clean. I get a chance to talk to them. Because one of the things that happens is stressors exceed their coping skills. See, when you're a 15, 16-year-old, you start getting high. Your coping skill becomes getting numb. And those adult skills you learn in teenager and early adulthood of how to deal with stress and cope with things, you don't develop those. Now you're 25, you're sober, and we expect you to be a 25-year-old adult. You don't have the coping skills. You'll learn them, but there are going to be times in your life where your coping skills are exceeded by your stress level. Somebody dies, you lose a job. You know, that's going to get any of us. Well, what it does to them is they go back to, I need to get numb. And when they do that, they have to have coping skills to get around it. Unfortunately, their coping skills to go back to getting high again, which, it's not 1 year in treatment and you're done. It's a lifelong thing. I like having some of these folks on 2 milligrams of Suboxone that see me every 2 months, 3 months, get their script. I can do that in Kentucky now. They've been sober for 2 years and, they're on a stable dose and they're in chronic maintenance. Kentucky law now allows me to stretch their visits out to as long as every 3 months. It used to be I had to see them every month forever. And that's hard to keep a job when you have to see the doctor every single month to get a prescription. You know, my door's open, but the ones that are doing well, they don't come back but every 2 or 3 months. So when we talk about treating them, you guys know what naloxone is? Narcan is the trade name for it. Now, Narcan is not a treatment. I just included it here for completeness. The where it falls apart is that we don't have a way of treating them or getting them into treatment once we revive them. That doesn't mean we don't use it. That means we work on that broken part of the system, right? I don't get angry very often. I don't know, I don't sound like that's true, but I really don't anymore. One of the things that really ticks me off on Facebook is this post, and maybe some of us meaning differently have posted it, but it's inflammatory. Why is Narcan free for addicts and insulin's not free for diabetics? Or chemo for, I hate that. It's apples and oranges. For one thing, Narcan's not a treatment. Narcan and naloxone, when opiates bind to your brainstem, if they do it in a high enough level, they suppress that drive to breathe. You know how you've all have breathed 100 times while you've been in here and you've not thought about it once because your brainstem's doing that for you. Well, opiates suppress that, so you just go to sleep and you don't remember to breathe. Narcan knocks the opiate off that brainstem and you start breathing again. So what kind of human being could possibly advocate there's a person laying on the ground, you may or may not know anything about them, they're not breathing, and you're holding the thing that'll make them breathe, but you won't give it because somebody told you they've already been revived 5 times. Are you kidding me? You know, I mean, we need to fix what we do with them afterward, but come on. You know, I was at a town hall meeting, and this lady, she meant well. You know, if people are trying, because I think there's this you got to be tough on them, you got to be tough. Yeah, in the appropriate way. You know, just letting them die doesn't solve any problems, right? Dead people don't go into recovery. Dead people can't be witnessed to, right? And this lady, you know, it was a couple pastors that set up this town hall meeting, and this lady very innocently asked, so how many times before you stay stop? How many times do you not Narcan them? Or you stop before you stop giving them the Narcan? There's jurisdictions that want to limit it, right? The 3 strikes, you're out, and stuff like that. And, I was ready to blow up. I was going to cut her down. I had so many smart aleck comments. And then God said, close the door of offense, Mike. And I just looked at her calmly and said, 70 times 7. You know what I'm referring to, right? Peter said, Lord, how many times do I forgive my brother's sins against me? Once, twice, 7 times? No, I tell you, 70 times 7. So you have it from, I'm straight from Jesus on 491. You can skip the Narcan. I doubt you're going to meet anybody that's been Narcan 490 times. But if you do, you could probably justify with Scripture not giving the Narcan. Anything less than that, right? Period. Now you could be angry with them, you whatever. Okay, fix that part of the problem. Let's figure out what we're going to do with the fish when we caught it. But let's bring them back to life first. That's what we're called to do. When you're talking about treatment, remember what I said about the receptors? They're like locks on a door. A key that goes in the lock and turns it is an agonist. The main opiate agonist we use in treatment is methadone. Methadone was invented in the 30s by the Bayer Corporation. There's a rumor that I don't know if it's true or not that its original trade name was Dolophine. If you remember what Germany was doing, Bayer's a German company, and Dolophine was actually, theoretically at least, named after Adolf Hitler. But that's a rumor. I don't know if it's true or not. But the original trade name before it went generic was Dolophine. What methadone is, it's a pain medicine. It's an agonist. But it's got some interesting qualities. It's long-acting. So you can give it, and there's enough of it lasting tomorrow that you're not withdrawal yet. instead of like a Percocet that wears off in 4 to 6 hours. There's an 8 to 10 hour lag time between giving it and any feelings of euphoria or stimulation of the mu receptor. So you can dose it so that you can dose somebody under the threshold where they're getting a buzz and acting abnormal. If you're careful, that means you're dosing them properly. And sometimes that's not the truth, right? But at least theoretically, you can dose them at a level that they're not high, but they're feeding the opioid receptor, so they're not in withdrawal. And it could be made cheaply. In the late 50s, when doctors started looking at opioid addiction, they started saying, you know, this is a chronic progressive brain disease that will always result in death. You know, we can give them a little bit of quality time if we can slow it down. And that was the theory of the methadone clinic to begin with, which it's no wonder that AA rebelled against that, right? AA started saying, oh, that's treating a drug with a drug and blah, blah, blah. And that violated their sensibilities. But in reality, that's not true. They were wrong. There's plasticity with brain chemistry. It can return to normal over time. However, there are some learned behaviors. Yeah, we know that. But the bottom line is we need something to stabilize that brain so that someone who's wild and they wake up in the morning and their only thing is fear and a fight or flight mechanism and how am I going to not get sick today, ruling their existence so that they can stabilize and look at that circle and work their way through that circle. You know, that's what's got to happen. If you brought your 25-year-old child to me and I evaluated him and said, this child has stage 4 cancer and they're going to die within 10.4 years. Now, I have chemotherapy. It's cheap. They have to go it every day. If they do what they're told and manage it properly, as long as they're on it, they will not live. This disease won't touch them. Now, if they deviate from the instructions, yeah, maybe it'll get them. But if they stay on it, I'm giving them a chance. They stay on it, they're safe. I don't know yet if they're going to need it forever or for a little bit of time. How many people are against me on this? You're going to stop me? Say, no, I'm just going to take him home and pray for him, doc. No, you're going to fight for your kid. Let me change two words. Change cancer to heroin addiction and change chemotherapy to methadone or Suboxone. Now everybody's got, yeah, no, you can't do that. We got to recognize the seriousness of what we're dealing with. The rest of my statement's true. 10.4 years is the average lifespan of these kids. Period. We're not acting enough. That's why they're dropping like flies. We got to do something. Your personal feelings about methadone, they need to be put aside, deal with scientific. Now, we need to make those clinics step up and treat the right way. You know, everybody being on 180 milligrams is ridiculous. They don't need it. Okay, and there is a problem there. But one of the problems is that the subpar clinics are allowed to exist because they can fly under the radar because, you know, there's this huge push to get rid of them anyway, and the people that could do it legitimately aren't even going to step up because they're not going to face that scrutiny, right? So, I mean, we need to clean up our attitude on that. Not everybody's going to need methadone, but the stage 4 cancers need methadone, right? Period. I mean, you've been through everything. It buys you time, at least. Maybe they don't need it forever. Maybe they move through that cycle and go, dead people don't recover. Dead people can't be witnessed to. You know, we got to protect life. A key that goes in the door and breaks off after a quarter turn is Suboxone. I know we all have mixed feelings about Suboxone, or buprenorphine is the drug that's in Suboxone. We have mixed feelings about Suboxone. The reality is Suboxone has a ceiling effect. There's a point where it actually starts to become more of an antagonist if you take too much of it. If you take more than 3 or 4 a day, it actually starts giving you withdrawal symptoms. You can't overdose and die on Suboxone alone. You can't. I challenge anybody on that. Sure, I know people, too, that have died on Suboxone, but look at their tox report. There's a ton of other stuff in their system, usually Xanax, right? So people don't usually die from Suboxone. They don't die from... If it's used right and it's combined with proper counseling and spiritual guidance, a lot of people get better. And I've got 100 patients that I can show you 90 of them are doing stellarly. The other 10 are struggling a little bit, but they're alive and they're supporting their kids. You know, who are we to judge? You know, that's not the normal. We're taught as normal, but, you know, there's an injectable antagonist you get once a month called Vivitrol. Vivitrol is like a blocker that sits over that lock. Stabilizes the lock somehow to limit craving, but also they know they can't get high. Well, it's extremely difficult to get high on Vivitrol. And going back to that ringing the bell thing, right? If your bell's getting rung and you say, well, that's a problem, I can't eat anyway, eventually the behavior's extinguished, the triggers get lower. So So Vivitrol works, but it's again, it's not a stellar idea. One thing I'm hoping will help us a lot more, there's a once-a-month injection of Suboxone now called Sublocade. It's been out since January. I'm hoping that'll be helpful. Yes, it's expensive, but you know, if you have rheumatoid arthritis, your medicine's expensive too. You know, it's next. So there's kind of a summary. On the left, you see all the effects that opiates do in there in your system. Drowsiness, confusion, memory loss, fatigue, hallucinations, convulsions, dilation of blood vessels and causing increased pressure in the brain, causing some brain damage. Pupils are usually constricted. They're wide when they're in withdrawal. Respiratory suppression, slurred speech, nausea and weight loss. As a matter of fact, when people are in recovery, they usually gain weight because they're able to eat. Using that drug all the time, you don't eat much, and when you can eat, you don't feel well, and you go days without eating because you're high anyway. Well, if you put some weight on them, get them healthy, you know, if you're doing recovery, weigh them. That guy that dropped 10 pounds, circle back, ask him some questions. He might have started using again. Weight loss for some is the first sign that if your kid's looking gaunt, gently confront him. Say, look, I notice you're losing some weight. It might be that they don't like the 30 pounds they put on in rehab and they're just trying to lose it, but you know, question them about that. Weight loss can be a sign of a relapse. Other effects that come with using these, if you're using needles, they're usually non-sterile. You're mixing with all kinds of crap to get it into solution so you can inject it. You're getting brain abscesses, skin abscesses, lung abscesses, endocarditis, hepatitis, HIV. You know, that's a whole other talk. We could go into that stuff, but endocarditis is a heart valve infection, heart lining infection. Usually requires a heart valve to be replaced. That whole hospital stays about $600,000, and they stay on Coumadin the rest of their life. So, if it doesn't kill them. So where are we? Where are we headed? Where do we got to go with this? We have to, what's it going to take to fix this? I mean, that's what we really want to know, right? I mean, that's why you're here. We got to use the tools that the Lord gives us to form a comprehensive approach and attack this problem. We got to find a new normal that includes people in long-term recovery. Sometimes it means, I'm never advocating that we question God's command or his orders or what he's told us or his will, but our opinions might need to be tweaked a little bit. You know, that normal includes people in long-term recovery. Is someone who's been on Suboxone 10 years and is sober, and are they really sober? I have AA sponsors that won't let somebody count their sobriety date because they're on Suboxone. You know, one sobriety dates, if you're not in AA, sobriety date is something you're very proud of, especially when years start to go by and you get coins. You know, my sobriety, you meet an addict on the street that's been sober 5 years, I'll tell you, my sobriety date is August 21st, 2013. Right off the bat, they know it. They're not allowed to count it. You know, sobriety, by AA's terms, is you're not taking mood-altering substance, which if you're using Suboxone properly, it's not mood or mind-altering, and it's managed by a doctor very carefully. If you're doing it appropriately, you're not using, you're not getting high, and you've worked through your 12 steps, you're good. That's sober. Because simply not using a substance by AA definition is not sobriety, right? AA even says that. They have the concept of a dry drunk, right? A dry drunk is an alcoholic who's not drinking, but they're doing nothing else. That's not considered sober. So obviously sobriety is something besides just abstaining. There's a lot to it. And this new normal, including these people in it, because you know, with HIV 30 years ago, if you had HIV, we told you you're gonna die within five years. Now they're living 30 years with it. You know, they may take medicine, but you know, we have to rethink, how do we keep people alive? How do we do what God wants us to do? How do we use the tools God gives us? You guys remember John 8, right? In John 8, one of my favorite stories in the Bible, a woman's caught in adultery and she's brought to Christ. And the rabbis are trying to trick him. They're trying to say, Rabbi, we caught this woman in adultery. What do you say we do with her? Because if he says stone her, he's upholding the law, the Old Testament, and he saves face as a teacher in the eyes of the people. If he says, well, you know, slap her on the hands, let her go, he's not upholding the law. If he says kill her, which is the right answer, then the Romans are going to arrest him for inciting a riot. So he's trapped, right? He's not even worried about it. He's writing in the dirt. I don't even know what he's writing. It wasn't important, but he's writing in the dirt. And he stands up and he walks right past them and ignores everybody else, looks her right in the face. Says, "You're right. He who's without sin cast the first stone." They all go, "Crap." And they walk away, beaten. But he's not done, because he's talking to her. He's not even listening to them. He looks at her and says, "Woman, where are your accusers? I find no fault in you. You're standing in front of me in judgment, and I'm forgiving you. I find no fault in you. Go and sin no more." He reminds us he's the judge. We all deserve his judgment, and we're all going to stand in front of it someday. We're not allowed to judge each other. He's clear about that. He reserves the right to judge. So, and I think that's all I got. So, I'm off my soapbox. So, I think as we're leaving, if anybody has any questions, I'm happy to answer. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so we have a son who's on Suboxone.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm okay with that, but he's also experiencing seizures.
Mm-hmm.
And he's on seizure medication,
okay.
And he's on Suboxone. And I don't know if both know what he's on or whatever. I can't be a part of that. But can Suboxone, and if he's taking Xanax, can that cause seizures?
Absolutely. And withdrawing from the Xanax can.
Why
especially if he's physically dependent on the Xanax, that's usually where the seizures come from. I mean, you got to look really hard at that. Is there abuse of the Xanax and then he's running out? Like if he's getting 40 of them a month and he's taking them all in a week and then, you know, middle of the month he's having a seizure, guess what? He's abusing the Xanax and running out and having a withdrawal seizure. Again, it's proper use of it. I'm not going to say I never write Xanax. I will not allow a Suboxone patient to have Xanax. If I have to use a benzodiazepine, which I don't like to, but when somebody's sitting in front of me, I'm asking myself, if I treat this anxiety issue or the panic attack or whatever, if I treat it cautiously, am I going to improve their chances of staying sober or make them worse? If I fail to treat it, are they more likely to relapse? And if I feel I can do it safely, I will treat it with that. But I use the lowest dose of the weakest benzo that I can get away with, and I really try to keep it. I mean, if I write a script for a benzo, I try to keep it at like 10 or 12 a month, no more. And because if you need a benzo three times a day, you've got more than an anxiety problem. You've got a mood disorder that needs to see a psychiatrist and whatever. But I hate Xanax because all the overdose deaths that have been reported on Suboxone have been on Xanax.
Do the Suboxone clinics, do they do anything to check to see what a patient is on?
They should. They should be getting drug screens and confirming those positives. But
well, they do drug screens, yeah, but only to see if he's taking opioids.
Right. Now, they need to do other stuff, too. And I probably need to back off because I'm going to, I don't know the situation, but I can tell you what I do. Sir, someone hit another?
Is there a gateway to opioid addiction? Like, for example, I have two sons that are adopted out of, they were addicted to meth when they were born. Are there things that we've identified that are triggers for these people that bring it up physically?
There may be some. We know that kids that are born into drug addiction may have a higher risk of developmental delay. Things that we can help, we can work on, but nonetheless we need to look for them. Speech delays are common. There's probably a genetic predisposition. If their parents were addicted, they may have a predisposition for addiction. So you just have to be very careful. Predisposition doesn't mean, if you're predisposed to be diabetic, it doesn't mean you have to be diabetic. It just means you have to intelligently treat yourself and avoid it and take the precautions needed. And yeah, they probably are predisposed to it. Yeah. But you know, there's plenty of people that can crawl out of the pool that they were thrown into.
I have a son. He's 45 years old. He has been addicted since 14. He's been fighting addiction since he was 14. We've been through every program that there is. He was on methadone for like 4 years, and then he went into Suboxone. Number one, the cost of the medication is a big.
Yeah, obviously.
If it's this effective,
can be.
It can be, but it hasn't been for him.
Or give me something better. Yeah, that's the sad truth is we're going to lose some anyway.
It, like
we're still
going to
lose
drugs,
some.
You know, he's abused it too.
We're still going to lose some, but you know it.
I know.
We got to get better.
I mean, I will say this: it has kept him for 2 to 3 years at a time in a stable place.
Keep praying.
I do.
With and for.
Yeah. But I'm praying for the cost of it
yeah,
to be
absolutely.
More available.
You're right.
And for
thank you.
For more doctors that probably sound like you that are more hands-on because he's been involved in a lot of clinics that are not that way.
No.
And if, but that's just.
Absolutely.
Thank
you're
you.
Right. Yes, ma'am.
Yes.